Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Our guest today is Dr. Lisa McGuire. Dr. McGuire is the epidemiology and surveillance team leader at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. She has a PhD in lifespan developmental psychology from Bowling Green State University, and she's worked as a fellow at the National Institutes of Mental Health. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you very much.
And the CDC has a roadmap that deals with brain health. Would that be the general name of that?
We do, through our Healthy Brain Initiative. We had a public health roadmap for state and national partners that was developed and released in 2013, and it will remain in effect through 2018. And this document outlines 35 action items for state and local public health officials that focuses on brain health, cognitive impairment, and Alzheimer's disease, and the needs for caregivers. We are currently revising our roadmap, and the new roadmap will be released this summer, and it will be for 2018 through 2023.
I read the most recent one that I could find, and it said that Alzheimer's was increasing in the United States. Is that still true now?
Yes, that is still true, even in 2018. The greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is increasing age, and as the number of older Americans continues to increase, the number of individuals who have Alzheimer's disease will increase as well.
I thought that the life expectancy in the American population had declined a little bit in the last few years. Is that true, or did I get that wrong?
We're seeing increases in the older adult population. We have more older adults in our society than we have historically. We're seeing that our society has more older adults than we have historically, and the fastest growing segment of the United States is those over the age of 85.
There's a term you use that seems pretty obvious, but I wonder, the term is cognitive decline. And what's the connection between cognitive decline and dementia, or when does cognitive decline become dementia?
Well, cognitive decline is a continuum, and it can occur from somebody having very early signs of forgetfulness, which might be forgetting their keys and doing so more frequently, and it might progress into a disease state that is diagnosed by a physician as a specific type of dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease. So anywhere on that continuum we refer to as cognitive decline.
And you gather statistics on this. I understand that they are self-reported. People determine whether they feel they're in cognitive decline. Is that right?
Right. CDC collects data on a whole variety of health topics across the United States, and CDC as a public health agency is really charged with monitoring the health of our nation. And one way we do that at CDC is through behavioral risk factors. Surveillance system, which is the largest telephone survey on health actually in the whole world. And with this survey, each state decides which questions they would like to ask on their state survey, and they call individuals within their state to complete the information on the survey. So one of the types of things that we ask people about from the CDC is a thing referred to as subjective cognitive decline, which is really a self-evaluation of their memory. And so in other words, how do they interpret their memory functioning within the past year? And for public health professionals, this is really important because this is an indicator of future burden and needs that may occur in the healthcare system, long-term services and supports, and in communities. We do know in Oregon in 2016 that 1 out of 9 people residing in Oregon indicate that they have had noticeable changes in their memory and confusion in the past year.
I thought that the decline of memory was inevitable with age. Am I wrong in that?
Well, there are what we refer to as normal changes in memory, and then those are that are can be more of a disease state. So this is one reason why at CDC we recommend that if you're having some changes in your memory, especially if those changes are interfering with your ability to engage in social activities, work, or volunteering, that you speak to a healthcare provider about your concerns, and they can let you know if it is just the normal aging process that's going on, or if there's something else going on that could be a type of dementia.
Right. It's sort of a matter of degree then. You use the term healthy aging related to the brain. What does that mean, healthy aging of the brain functions?
Well, healthy aging or brain health, what we're referring to is we're wanting people to be able to live life to the fullest for them, so maintaining their health and independence as long as possible. And so at CDC, we recognize that the types of activities that are good for your heart are also good for your head. So, you know, eating a healthy diet, exercising, those things that are very beneficial to your heart will also be beneficial to your brain health.
Is there treatment for Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's disease is a irreversible and progressive type of dementia. So unfortunately, there is not currently a cure for Alzheimer's disease. But there are medications and other types of interventions that are available once somebody talks to their healthcare provider. So some of these interventions can help with slowing down the memory loss or some of the behavioral or other symptoms that a person may be experiencing.
Is there a medication?
The drugs that are available for Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementias really are to treat symptoms. Right. They are not cures for the actual condition.
And what causes Alzheimer's? I don't understand that.
Well, Alzheimer's disease results from neurological changes that occur in the brain. The actual causes of it is being researched by the National Institute on Aging, also, and they're also researching cures and prevention.
So we don't know what causes it. So you're not going to attribute that to diet or lifestyle or any of that?
Well, as I mentioned before, what's good for the heart is also good for the brain. So the diet, lifestyle issues would factor into that. Heredity is a risk factor, and unfortunately, we cannot do anything about heredity or chronological age.
Do you have a sense of how much of a risk factor heredity is, the likelihood of getting it if one of your ancestors had it?
It really depends on the specific type of the dementia. And once again, I would consult with a neurologist or the National Institute on Aging for that.
And you talk about caregivers. This is an important aspect of this disease. Do you deal with caregivers? Do you have any help? Is there any way that you help them?
Well, just like we collect information on the health of the nation around subjective cognitive decline, we do the same thing at CDC for caregivers. So for individuals or people who are over the age of 18 years old and older, we ask them if they are a caregiver. And that means, are they providing care to a friend or family member who has a specific type of health condition? And then we ask them questions about their specific health, about their caregiving situation. So what type of health condition that person has that they're caring for, how long they've been caring for them, and if they're currently not a caregiver, if they plan to be on a caregiver in the future. So we know that the health of caregivers is extremely important at CDC and across the nation. We know that in Oregon, one out of six people who are a caregiver to a friend or family member are caring for someone who is an older person, and also they have a child in the home that they're caring for as well. And about a third of those caregivers in Oregon are providing 20 or more hours a week caring for a friend or family member. So we do want to reiterate that for caregivers, caring for themselves is extremely important, because caregivers need to also stay healthy so they can take care of, continue their caregiving role and responsibility if they choose to.
Does CDC offer any resources in terms of helping caregivers or helping people understand the disease? I mean, I see a lot of material on your website, and maybe that's what we get from y'all. Are there any more specific things that come out of your work that our listeners would be able to connect with?
The CDC does have some educational materials available on our website for caregiving. We also work with different healthcare provider organizations to provide training for healthcare providers. So they recognize healthcare providers recognize the value and role and importance of caregivers that they're providing within that family structure, and also encouraging healthcare providers to ask somebody that they know is a caregiver make sure that their health is okay as well too. So we're working on increasing the awareness and helping to maintain the health and care and independence of caregivers.
So the issue is, who's taking care of the caregivers? Who's giving them the care they need? What's the prognosis for the treatment of Alzheimer's and brain aging in general? Do you have some thoughts about that?
Once again, I would encourage you to talk to the National Institute on Aging, because they're the ones looking at the cure and treatment aspects.
Right, right. So that
they got hundreds of studies doing this, so they could tell you the latest science.
And I didn't ask you this before, but does the current budget preserve this effort and the importance of it, of treating Alzheimer's, the work you're doing, the work that they're doing? Are those things still in the 2018 budget?
Well, the 2018 budget is not official yet. We're still under a continuing resolution. So I do not know if that is preserved in the 2018 budget. We were preserved in the 2017 budget and the 2016 budget. We were level funded.
Seems with this disease increasing and with the aging of the population continuing in the way that it's been accelerating, that this should be a high priority. Dr. McGuire, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything I should have asked you that you would like to mention?
The only thing that I'd like to mention is that there's 5.5 million adults in the United States that have Alzheimer's disease currently. We know that Alzheimer's disease is one of the most costly diseases in the U.S., $259 billion in 2017. And Alzheimer's disease is the fifth leading cause of death for people 65 years old and older.
Dr. McGuire, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Next, we speak with Portland-based social gerontologist and community educator Jeanette Liardi. Jeanette is talking about issues of primary concern, notably ageism, brain fitness, creativity, intergenerational communication, and caregiver support systems. Jeanette, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You're known as a specialist here in Portland on the subject of aging. What is ageism, and how does it affect our society?
Well, ageism is actually any form of prejudice or discrimination that's based on a person's age, which actually can also be related to young people as well. We can be ageist toward young people, just as younger people could be ageist toward older adults. So it's any form of prejudice or discrimination that uses age as the guide.
We're living in what I think of as a youth-oriented culture here in Portland. Is ageism more prominent here, or is this just the norm?
Actually, ageism is the norm. We're not only in a youth-centered culture here in Portland, we're in a youth-centered culture in our entire country.
Did you say the word gerontophobia?
Gerontophobia, the fear of being old and the fear of old people.
Is that a reality?
It is a reality. The thing is, Portland, if anything, is a little bit better in terms of being more welcoming to the concept of aging. And because, as your audience will probably know about, the age-friendly movement in Portland, Portland as a city is a little more advanced in that way than many other places in the country.
By the age-friendly movement, you mean that the fact that we're part of that World Health Organization group of.
It was the first U.S. city to be designated age-friendly by the World Health Organization. And Portland is always usually included on lists of best places to retire. So Portland itself is a little bit better, but we still, if you look at national TV ads and talk show monologues, ageism is rampant in our culture, that everything that is youth-centered is considered better than getting old, because we're so afraid of getting old.
Would you agree this is a good place to retire?
people are attracted to Portland because of the lifestyle. The options here are greater. The culture is more vibrant than in many other places. The affordability of housing, though, is a big problem. So it depends on the retirees' income levels. And health care here is very good for older adults compared with lots of other places in the country.
And Portland isn't an inexpensive place to retire.
No, it's not.
Not just housing, but other things,
Other things, too. That's right. That's right. So when we're talking about quality of life for older adults, it really is a combination of what the individual is experiencing and bringing to the experience of retirement, plus what society can provide for the retiree. And that's a challenge all around the country. But I think Portland, in certain ways, housing is a challenge. I think transportation is a little bit better here than in other parts of the country for older adults.
Well, give us an example of what you mean by one of these negative stereotypes.
The big one is defining aging solely as a condition of deterioration and decline, that as we get older, we fall apart. Our hearing goes, our eyesight goes, those kinds of things. But what we don't understand as a population is that we actually, there are some certain things we gain as we get older. A lot has to do with the changes in the brain, and the older brain actually is different from the middle-aged and younger brain, and in some ways is better. And when I talk about brain fitness, I really emphasize those points because people are very surprised to hear that.
Whatever happened to the idea of older people being wise and contributing to society with their wisdom?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we have that at one time, or did we ever have it?
I think we had it to a certain extent in the American culture. Other cultures are better at it than we have been. But actually, that concept of aging wisdom really goes back thousands and thousands of years before the existence of writing, because how did society understand what needs to be done except through the tales and the experiences of older adults?
Lately, I've heard a couple of terms that are new to me, positive aging and anti-aging. What do they mean?
Let me start with anti-aging. Anti-aging has different meanings depending on what you're talking about. There's a scientific definition of aging that is the death of our cells. Our cells duplicate a certain number of times, and then they start to lose their ability to replicate themselves. So we have our DNA, our chromosomes, have these long strands at the ends of which are called little bits called telomeres. And every time they multiply, the telomere gets a little shorter and shorter. Now, there are scientists working on trying to reverse that process, and that would be anti-aging in its scientific sense, to stop the death of cells or to delay the death of cells. But then we also have a cultural definition of anti-aging, which is anything that covers up or delays the aging process. And I'm talking about things like wrinkle creams and dyeing your hair, covering your gray. Those things don't delay the aging process or reverse the aging process. They just cover it up. Positive aging also is another term that's used differently depending on the context. Positive aging in a very superficial sense, and another phrase for it sometimes is called successful aging, is when people assume that the individual is solely responsible for their quality of life and their ability to age. And to some extent, it's true. We do need to eat well and sleep, have enough sleep and exercise, but that's not the whole story. So positive aging, in its truest sense, means to have a positive attitude about aging, but it also implies that society will provide opportunities for people to age well. The two have to go together. It can't just be the individual's responsibility. I prefer the term empowered aging rather than positive aging or successful aging. By the way, having a positive attitude about aging can actually prolong your life by about 7.5 years.
Is aging considered an illness or a disease?
Aging itself is not a disease, although if you speak with the scientists that are working on the telomere lengthening, prolonging that, they might want to reterm it as a disease, redefine it as a disease. But living long itself is not the disease. So I tend to not want to see aging as an illness. It's not something wrong. It's something we're supposed to do. Some scientists have said that the person who will live to be 150 is already born, that they are making such strides that they can increase the longevity. When you talk to a biomed gerontologist like Aubrey de Grey, he's from the SENS, SENS Research Foundation in California. He's one of the scientists who's working on extending life longevity and seeing aging, redefining aging as an actual illness to be cured. There are different methodologies that scientists are looking into. Calorie restriction, the University of Southern California is looking into that. There's a substance called NMN, which repairs the damage caused by sun and radiation to our cells, and that's being looked at the University of New South Wales. There's immunotherapy. All kinds of approaches are being taken. So scientists are working on it, and, you know, they may get there, but I would prefer to see for now that aging, if we can embrace aging as something that's a good thing, and especially, as I mentioned before, what our brains can do as we get older, we become much more better able to use both sides of our brain, both hemispheres of our brain, the older we get. We are we have better longer-term memories than younger people do. We have more gathered experience, and that's the wisdom that we can talk about as we get older. We have more experience against which to apply new situations to. And older adults, if they keep their brains healthy, are better at that than younger people are. So there are some good things about getting older that we need to really accept and celebrate.
So what's your advice to people here in Portland who are aging and over 70 or over 80? We've got an increasing amount of number of people in that group. What do you tell them to think about?
I tell them to stay engaged, be glad about getting older, be proud of getting older, be out there in the world and assert yourself as an older person, and to surround yourself with people of all ages, because we can all be models of what positive aging can be about. There's a lot we can learn from younger generations, and there's a lot that younger generations can learn from us. So that's what I would recommend. Be out there, take care of your body, take care of your mind, challenge your mind, and think about the things that you can contribute, that the talents and skills that you have amassed and your wisdom that you have amassed over a lifetime, and how you can share that. Not only will it help our society and increase our social productivity, it'll keep you living longer. That's, I think, the more natural way to extend your life.
You're saying that ageism is the only prejudice that we're all susceptible to. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's ironic that not all of us are susceptible to racism or homophobia or sexism, but we're all getting older. So if we don't solve some of these ageist stereotypes, you know, knock them down, we're doing future generations a disservice, because they're going to face it as well. They're going to face the marginalization and isolation. They're going to be denied opportunities for work, and their productivity will be reduced.
You just heard Portland-based gerontologist and community educator Jeanette Liardi. And finally, we're going to revisit our interview with Vicki Nice, nationally known bioethicist. Here, Vicki is talking about practical tools that you can use in helping people make decisions on end-of-life issues. You talk about four tools to use when making the difficult life, health, and end-of-life decisions. Tell us what they are and how you use them.
So these are wonderful tools, and I first learned how to use them, you know, as a bioethicist, but I started using them in my personal life when I was taking care of my dad, who had vascular dementia, and his mental abilities were that of somebody maybe 7 years old. And so the four tools and the way they worked for my dad, the first one is called the decision-making framework. And this tool helps to make sure that we are respecting the person's wishes when we know them. So I made sure that I honored my dad's wishes. And then there's different techniques within this framework that help us know what to do when we don't know what the person would want and we're just doing the best we can. The second tool I think is my favorite. It's called the shared decision-making model. And what this says is, depending on the person's mental age, people have a larger or smaller voice in their own decisions. So this actually comes from pediatric ethics. In pediatric medicine, What we do is we allow children who are 14 to 17 years old mentally, not just physically, but their mental abilities, quite a bit of voice and sometimes a full decision-making power in their medical decision. Somebody that's 7 to 13, they'll probably have some voice, some choice, but you're certainly not going to let an 8-year-old make serious medical decisions. So we adjust the power of their voice and their ability to make choice based on their mental age. Somebody who's 0 to 6, you might let them choose, you know, do I want chocolate or vanilla ice cream? But you're certainly not going to let them make big, important financial or medical decisions.
That makes sense. What's the next one?
The third tool is the sliding scale for decision making. And it works with the tool that I just described, where it says, based on the person's mental age, we can let them make more dangerous decisions or less dangerous. So the higher the level of capacity, the more serious or consequential the decision they can make. As their mental ability decreases, then we want to make sure we're only giving them easier, less consequential decisions. And this one really gives families and caregivers the confidence to know I'm doing the right thing because I'm letting them have power and control when it's safe, but I'm stepping in when I need to.
Important distinctions. And the fourth one.
The fourth tool is called the ascent tool, and we use it when somebody is maybe in the 7 to 13-year range. And this is a tool where we let them have some voice over parts of the decision. So, for instance, when I was moving my dad into an assisted living that had a dementia area, he didn't make the decision that he needed to move because his mental ability was 7, right? So I had to make the decision. I had to make sure there was enough money in his accounts. I had to make sure that they had good nurses there. But I could allow him to decide whether or not he wanted to bring his favorite chair, which clothes he wanted to bring, what sheets would he want on the bed at the new place. I could let him have power and control over smaller things that were within a safe range for him to decide.
That was Vicky Kind, a nationally known bioethicist and gerontologist whom we profiled in episode 16 of Retired or Rewired. We give the final word to a famous actress. Can you guess who said this? I want to grow old without facelifts. I want to have the courage to be loyal to the face I've made. Sometimes I think it would be easier to avoid old age, to die young, but then you'd never complete your life. You'd never wholly know you. Those are the words of Marilyn Monroe. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.